Accession number 22100, wheel 1.
Reel 1, side 1, Lieutenant Gordon Cantley. Can you start, please, by telling me your full name and your date of birth?
William Gordon Cantley, spelt with an A, C-A-N-T-L-A-Y, 13th of December 1921.
Okay. And where were you born?
Aberdeen, in Scotland.
And what did your father do?
He was managing director of a retailing organisation.
And where did you go to school?
In outside Glasgow, a town called Rutherglen.
Right. And can you tell me a bit about your schooling?
Yes, the first schooling was when we lived down in England, at Loughton in Essex, and I went to a small school out there called Holmcroft, H-O-L-M-C-R-O-F-T. With my cousin who lived with us, a lady now, and my younger brother. Eventually we moved back up to Scotland around about 1928, and maybe a bit later than that, 1930-ish, and I went to Rutherglen Academy, which was quite a good school, and my education, I think, has been of a reasonably high standard. It seems to be much higher than my grandson's at the present moment in time, but there you go. Anything else you want to know?
What subjects did you study? Where was it all this leading you?
In Scotland, one aimed for the higher leaving certificate, the Scottish higher leaving certificate, and that included English, which included history and geography, and mathematics and French and art. These were the four subjects, really six subjects, which I took and achieved and passed. I did in fact turn out to be second ducks of the school, but I always seemed to get pipped at the post by somebody who was there.
And what were you planning to do?
Engineering.
Why was that? Why did you choose engineering?
My father had a friend who was an engineer, and it's very difficult to decide what to do when you're reaching sort of 16, 17. So this friend introduced me into the subject, and although I like mathematics as a subject anyway, so I thought, well, I'll have a go at this, and that's why I ended up in engineering.
And so at what stage did you leave school? What day did you leave school?
When did I leave school? 1939.
Right. And how aware were you of the sort of the international situation of what was
Well, we'd gone through the Munich palaver in 1938, and my father decided we would dig an air raid shelter at the bottom of the garden, and we found that the water table was about 3 feet down, so that was cancelled. And that was about all when the war commenced in 1939. It really was a phony war. In fact, I remember that I heard Mr. Churchill giving his oration, which was quite interesting. And then the night arrived, and all the street lights came on in the road in which we lived, which we all thought was rather strange. However, they went off fairly quickly after that, and in effect there was no real palaver until the war really started in 1940.
But at this stage, did you think that you were going to be involved? How did you feel about it?
Well, I was pretty certain I was going to be involved. I think I was 18 at the time, it's likely that something would happen fairly seriously. I did start my engineering classes at that particular stage, but when that was in 1940, I started the engineering classes, but well, I received a request from the King to go and help him fight the war.
Did anybody in your family have any military background?
My father was in the army. He had a bad heart, so he was in the artillery. I had an uncle who served in the Gordon Highlanders, and another uncle who served in the Gordon Highlanders during the war.
This was in the First War?
In the First World War, yeah.
So at what date then were you called up?
1941. I joined the army on the 19th of June, 1941.
But you'd had some military experience prior to that with the Home Guard.
I joined the Home Guard day one, so to speak, to be told that nobody knew anything about it and to come back in a couple of days' time. This was a friend of mine, a chap called Harry McLean, who's now deceased. And we served in the Home Guard for almost, 9 months, I suppose, almost a year.
And can you tell me a bit about that experience?
Well, as you can imagine, there was a mixture of old sweats and young lads. The old sweats were very good at bayonet drill, and of course they knew the basic drill anyway. Strange enough, we were commanded by Lieutenant Colonel Douglas, who happened to be my Latin master at school, so he knew me and I knew him. After that, we eventually received our rifles from America. I think they're called the P-something or another, I can't remember what it was. And these were degreased, etc. We were all allowed to take this home with us, including 5 rounds of ammunition. The object of the exercise was that one became... You attended, I think it was on a Sunday, one attended a parade all of the time. But during the week, in the evenings, you were down for duty at an air raid shelter, which was just on the edge of the country. And one used to spend the evening there with members of one section. I eventually reached the exalted rank of Lance Corporal. And I mentioned, I think, earlier that on one occasion, being in charge of the headquarters, the police phoned up to say that there had been reports of a parachutist in waste ground near the back end of the hall. So I set off with a couple of chaps, leaving Harry McLean sitting behind a Vickers machine gun. I don't know why we had a Vickers machine gun, but we did have. And it sitting in the hall with the Vickers machine gun, I went out into the dark with a couple of other chaps, and I fell over this chappy in a hole in the ground. He was just as surprised as I was, but he turned out to be a vagrant. We took him along to the police station and handed him over, but he was a vagrant. As I say, Colonel Douglas must have been told about this, so he arrived to open the door to be faced with this Vickers. Otherwise, we used to do exercises. We were called out. There was an alarm. I think it was round about September 1941. No, September 1940. Yes, September 1940, when there was an alarm expecting an invasion. And I was at home at the time, and we were phoned up and called to report to the headquarters, which I did. And walking down about a couple of miles from my house to the headquarters on a lonely dark road and knowing it was an invasion scare is not good for one's nerves. However, we took up positions on the edge of this particular battle area, and nothing happened. We were dismissed after about a morning.
What were you briefed in terms of your tasks? What were you expected to do?
We were in... slit trenches, and all I think we were supposed to do is to shoot the Germans if they approached these slit trenches. I can't recall that we were given any specific orders other than to hold these slit trenches.
And, I mean, what training did you receive within the
You received the basic sort of arms drill. One received a bayonet drill. We went to the ranges and fired the rifles. And in fact, I remember now I was appointed BAR man, which is the Browning Automatic Rifle. So I had a chance to fire that as well. After that, we did exercises where the young people were sort of chased out into the wild blue yonder to act as parachuters, whilst the majority of the squad attempted to encompass them and hold them in position. We did quite a lot of exercises, and we did route marches as well. That's really about all.
I mean, how seriously did people take it?
Oh, it was taken very seriously. It was indeed, you know, it was going to be, we were going to fight if we had to fight. There's no doubt about that. We were stiffened up by these ex-soldiers, as you can imagine, and the youngsters who'd had no experience of it but were quite prepared to have a go were there as well. It was a good time. It was a very comradely organisation.
And you enjoyed the military life?
You mean the Home Guard life?
Yeah.
Oh, it was very pleasant because, you know, one met up with seniors, men much older than oneself, and obviously it broadened one's viewpoint.
So you had about a year of this, and then you were called up in June 1941.
That's right, yeah.
Can you tell us about that?
Well, the thing that I remember most was it was a call to report to Ripon, Harper Barracks at Ripon. And at that particular time, we'd all been issued with, in the initial instance in the Home Guard, we started off with LDV armbands, and that one's one's uniform, and then eventually one got battle dress. And some of the battle dress fitted in parts, and some of it didn't fit. But anyway, the orders came that when you left, rather than hand in the battle dress, you wore the battle dress to the camp. So I met up in the railway train at Glasgow with about half a dozen other people who were joining at the same particular time. I didn't know them. But I was the only one in so-called battle dress. And, of course, I'd had Lance Corporal stripes on his sleeve, which had been taken off. And the battle dress fitted where it touched, ghastly thing it was. And we set off on this train, and we got to Ripon, and we thought, well, we've got an hour or two before we have to report, so we'll have a splendid breakfast before we go. So we went into a hotel on the square at Ripon and had a nice breakfast, and then we ambled up to the gate. Now, the others were accepted because they were all in civvy dress, but I was quickly quizzed, where's my AB-64, which I had no idea what an AB-64 was to start off with. But having persuaded the guard commander that I was what I was supposed to be and showed him my ticket to report, he said, all right, go to the company office. Now, this was me and myself, all the others had gone. And walking rather than marching along to the company office, I met the regimental sergeant major, who was rather distressed at this scruffy individual. However, we both explained ourselves, and I was allowed to proceed with a flea in the ear, but I think both of us learned something from that. After that, I was posted as a sapper to one of the sections. It was 49 Party, if I remember rightly, 49 Party, and our section leader was a Corporal Reynolds, assisted by a Lance Corporal Bellamy. I can't imagine how old these two gentlemen were, but I don't think either of them had war experience, but they were certainly older than, I was 19 at that particular time, than the rest of us. Now, the section comprised, I suppose, about 70% youngsters like myself, and 30% much older men. I would think they were probably in their 30s. Not many of them, but much more reluctant to perform. The huts we were in were the spider huts, which were very pleasant. You had the accommodation quarter. I think there were six accommodation quarters, and then in the centre was the ablution block. So it was all very comfortable, army biscuits to sleep on and this sort of stuff. But the actual training which we received was the initial 3 weeks to make us into soldiers, and it's quite remarkable how quickly one does absorb basic training. And then after 3 weeks, we were entitled to a long weekend. But unfortunately, just as we were about to go off on this long weekend. We were put on trucks and sent up to a place called Ramsgill near Pateley Bridge, where the Moors were on fire. We had to tackle these fires, but no sooner had we got started on beating out the blazing gorse than the heavens opened and down it came, and we were taken off to Ramsgill Church and introduced to Army Rum, which was quite an experience. So after that we got our leave, and then we came back, and then we did our basic training, which I think was at least another 6 weeks. And it was very good basic training. We'd started off at Ripon, but halfway through it we moved down to Newark-on-Trent into Bowbridge Road Camp. Bowbridge Road Camp was not spider huts, it was individual hutted accommodation, and the ablution block was out into the wild blue yonder. So it wasn't quite so comfortable in the winter time. This would be, I suppose, sometime around about September, October, November. Now it must have been 3 months training rather than six weeks training. Yes, 3 months training.
Can you say a bit about the syllabus of the training?
Of the training? Yeah. Well, we did... they called it sticks and strings, which was associated with things like shear legs and knots and lashings and all this sort of stuff. We did main bridging, which was dry bridging with the Bailey Bridge. We did wet bridging, which was pontoon bridging and rafting on the River Trent. We learnt how to row a cutter and the naval expressions with regard to tossing oars and all this sort of stuff. We did demolitions, the explosives, and I think that's just about all. In the meantime, we did firing exercises as well, associated with the Bren gun and the rifle. We were required to give examples of bridging to the people of Newark, I suppose, in order to encourage donations of money. So we built the odd bridge in the square at Newark to keep everybody's morale happy. But in the main, that was it. We did our field works at a place called Beacon Hill, just outside Newark. Just outside Newark. But in the main, it was a very good training, and I must admit, I learned a lot, which I've never forgotten, associated with knots and things of that sort of ilk.
Can you say a bit about the briefings that you received in terms of the role of the engineers in battle?
Never. Nobody talked big picture.
So you received the syllabus without really
having a context? We received the basic training to make you into a sapper, but nobody sort of said certain sappers do this and certain sappers do that. We just all received the initial same basic training wherever you were going.
Right. So nobody sort of introduced the concepts of mobility and counter-mobility?
No.
Did that come later?
None of that nonsense. I can't remember we've got a great deal of Aridoctu either, but there we go.
Okay, so having completed your basic training, what happened there?
Some of us were then appointed local acting unpaid lance corporals. Now, that gives a date, because I received that appointment on the 13th of December, 1941, which was, I think, my 20th birthday. So that name sticks, and that gives you a picture as to how long this training had taken, from the 19th of July to the 13th of December. And we were appointed as the supporting NCO to the section NCO with a new intake. In fact, I didn't have a supporting NCO, so I was responsible for the section and training them through. So we took them through their basic training. In fact, I think we probably took them right through. So probably with them, another 3 months. But this was on the understanding that we were potential officers. and we all were sent up to the Wasby in Marylebone sometime during that particular period of time. And all I remember of that is being asked to give a dissertation on Martinique, and giving a whole story on Madagascar instead. Towards the end, I realised I had been talking about the wrong island, and they said, "Well, that's all right." And I got through that, and then we went to Preoctu, I think, for 6 weeks, maybe less than that, down at what was it called? Bovie Tracy, somewhere down near Andover, stroke Winchester. And there we I can't really think we did very much there. I think we were just waiting for a slot, or worse of that sort of effect, or even more than that, they were combining the field octaves, 141 and 142, into a single octave. And we went first of all to Aldershot for a very short period of time, and then strangely enough we moved up to back to the camp at Newark, Burbage Road Camp, which I knew quite well. One became a cadet, and fundamentally the training which we received was more or less the sapper training once again, but except that in this particular occasion individuals were picked out to represent the officer in charge of the cadre, or the NCO as the case may be. So, but fundamentally that was the same sort of thing. You did the same old sweat, you pushed the old same old Bailey Bridge, you fired the same old weapons, etc., etc. The thing which we didn't get, which has always puzzled me, nobody gave us any real wireless instruction. And in fact, nobody gave us any indication of mess procedures, which, of course, at that particular stage in the game, one didn't notice. But when one joined a unit, you knew immediately what was missing. Very quickly, you were put into the line. But nobody gave you any of the background stuff. Now, nobody also gave you any indication, as you were talking, of what was the role of the sapper in wartime. It was just simply you were trained, and you were trained to be an officer. You were expected to respond to different problems which were put to you. You had chutes and all this sort of stuff. And in the main, as I say, the basic training was exactly the same as the sapper training. You went through exactly the same sort of stuff. But with this addition onto it of responsibilities which hadn't been imposed before.
Could I just ask, at what point were you selected for officer training? Was it during your initial recruit basic training?
Yeah.
And can you just describe the process, what happened there? Were you asked to volunteer, or
no.
Did somebody come and say?
So I don't know, but virtually all of my intake were put down as potential officers. I think that's probably pretty true. That's the group that I joined the army with, not the whole of the section, but the group that I joined the army with, which must have been about maybe 7 or 8 people. We were fingered fairly early on, and we were. We weren't told that it was, you know, it's a straightforward situation, but when we completed our initial training, which I suppose was their basic measurement of whether we were good enough or not good enough, we were told more or less that we would be taking this next cadre through, which would give us experience of commanding men, but we were down to go to, and during that period of time we attended this Wasby.
And during the period of your officer training, how up to date were you kept on the sort of progress of the war in general, in the sort of the Middle East and all the rest of it?
Well, I remember this was, 1942, and all that was happening in the Middle East really was absolute bloody chaos. We had had the bombing of Pearl Harbor in December 1941, so we knew that the Americans were coming into the shooting match. But in the main, one got newsletters and this sort of thing, but there was no sitting down and being lectured on what you might be expected to do or what you shouldn't do. You were concentrating upon your basic training again.
So you had no expectation as to where you would go at the end of this process?
Well, this was a field octo, so we knew we were going to field. The other octo, 143, was the Isle of Sea octo, and that was up in Scotland. I was sent up there later on, but we knew this was a field octo, but we had no idea which units we would be going to.
And can
when I say field, it was just, if you like, the opposite to Isle of Sea. We weren't going to become RTOs or words of that sort of effect. We were going to be in the shit somewhere.
Can you just say a bit more about the specific roles of a field unit as opposed to a line of communications unit?
Well, a field unit is normally in support of a division, as you know. In an infantry brigade, there were three brigades. An infantry division, there were three brigades. So there were three field companies, each field company supporting a brigade. And in an armoured division, there were two brigades. So there were two field squadrons, field squadron in an armoured division, a field company in an infantry division. And in addition to that, there was a field park squadron or company, as the case may be, which carried stores and 80 feet of bridging and general support to the two squadrons supporting the brigades. Each squadron supported its own individual brigade. I'll come to that in a moment or two, but that's the pattern with regard to field. You could have corps troops, which were also field, and they were under command of the corps commander, but they were also frontline troops. And you could have army troops, which were at the discretion of the army commander, but they could also be frontline troops. In effect, when I was posted to the Guards Armoured Division, 14th Field Squadron, and I joined them, I think, around about January 1943. That squadron supported the armoured brigade at that particular time, which comprised the 2nd Battalion of the Grenadier Guards, the 1st Battalion, the Coldstream Guards, and the 2nd Battalion, the Irish Guards. These were armoured regiments. In addition, there was a reconnaissance regiment, which was the 2nd Battalion, the Welsh Guards, but that was a reconnaissance regiment. Which wasn't, if you like, a fighting group with regard to the other three. And the sister squadron, 615 Field Squadron, supported the infantry brigade. These things changed in Normandy, and I'll talk about that later on. But that was the sort of pattern, the shooting match.
Could you just say a bit more about the structure of an armoured squadron?
A field squadron.
Field squadron, sorry.
There were three troops. One troop, two troop, and three troop, and a headquarters troop. And each troop was commanded by a lieutenant, and he had a troop sergeant with him. And he had three sections. Each troop had three sections. Number one troop had one, two, and three sections. Number two troop had four, five, and six sections. And similarly, number three troop had seven, eight, and nine sections. Each section comprised about 14 men, so each troop comprised about between 60 and 70 men. The hardware which we had was an armoured car for myself. Two of the sections were carried in international half tracks. The third section was carried in a three-tonner. In addition to that, there was a stores lorry,